All right, so we're still at Lang.net. We have two very special guests here. Please introduce yourself, sir.
So I'm Dan Engels.
Okay.
And I'm Alan Werfbrock. Okay, maybe we should introduce each other or describe each other, since probably individually, I don't know if...
That sounds like a great idea.
So let me introduce Dan as I know him and stuff. So Dan is, to me, is best known as one of the original creators of the Smalltalk programming and language environment. He was one of the original team members at Xerox PARC, working with Alan Kay. Could you do the implementation for Smalltalk 72? So really the original language implementer for that whole series of languages. Along the way, doing that work, I think there's a few other things that popped out along the way, like Dan invented Bitblit, I believe.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Pop-up menus, was that one of yours? you don't claim Windows, do you?
No. Although, certainly the early Smalltalk was one of the first manifestations of Windows, but it came... Actually, earlier, Alan's got the reference, and I'm trying to think of exactly what it was where it first showed up.
Anyway, so Dan has been intimately involved as one of the early and prime movers, really, of many things that we just think of as the core technologies our systems are built today on. Object-oriented programming, graphic user interfaces, all the specific sort of techniques and devices that go along with that, and Dan was there for the whole thing. So a couple other things about Dan, let's see, I'll throw in, after the Xerox PARC days, Dan spent some time at, quite a bit of time at Apple, and while he was at Apple, he got, well, I guess this was at Apple, but yeah, he basically started moving forward with an implementation of Smalltalk that eventually became known as Squeak. Now, that work continued right at Disney, I believe, so Squeak started at Apple, went on to Disney. Squeak is probably still the most widely available and widely used version of Smalltalk. It's freely available, and... you can tell us some more about Squeak if you want as we get into it. And Dan now works for Sun and has been doing very interesting things, Smalltalk-like things with JavaScript.
That's right.
Yep. Interesting. Yep. Very interesting. And who's this guy over here?
And Alan Werfbrock, we really first came together again around the Smalltalk systems, but he was at that time working at Tektronix, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Tektronix was one of the early adopters of the Smalltalk 80 system, and they did great things with getting it to run on the 68000. And that's where I've mostly known you from, and then over the years since then, as our paths have crossed.
So I guess the first question would be is, like, what led you, why Smalltalk? What led you to get involved in design this language, and what was so intriguing about it? What problems were you trying to solve? What was...
Yeah. Well, it was... it was an exciting time when I was at Xerox PARC, and a couple of things. I guess one of the things is that it was the period when bitmap displays first appeared, and that was a lot of the work done on the Alto originally. And there was all of this, you know, incredibly creative stuff just waiting to happen. So people often say, oh, it's so great you did this or that. But it was kind of a free ride in the creative space. You know, you could just, you'd think of these cool things and go home and work on them and make things happen, you know, the next day or that afternoon that just hadn't been done before. Mm-hmm. But to come back to about Smalltalk, I guess there were a number of factors that came into it, and really the germ of Smalltalk in specific came from Alan Kay. And I was there working at Xerox on other stuff. I was doing speech recognition and had an office across the hall from Alan Kay's, and kept being more interested in the conversations across the hall than what I was working on, and eventually went across the hall and we got together. I had been real interested in simple, terse, and interactive dynamic languages. the principal one at the time was APL, and Alan was, and also Lisp. Alan was talking about a way to build a language where the different parts of it would not depend on the internals of other parts, and finally, I think Ted Kaler and I, he said, well, we were talking about the kernel Lisp interpreter, which is, you know, can be described in just a half a page of code, and Alan said, well, you could do that we didn't call it object-oriented language, but with a language with intrinsic semantics is how we talked about it then. In just a half a page, and Ted Kaler and I said, show us, you know, you do that and we'll build it. So Alan went away for a couple of days, and when he came back, he had this sort of terse description of something that ought to behave that way. And then I went away for a week or two and wrote in BASIC an interpreter for this first language. And then out of that, you know, the thing actually worked the way we talked about it. So then I engineered that into performing. I recoded the thing in machine code, learned all this stuff from scratch about garbage collection and symbol tables and all that stuff. And that became the first Smalltalk 72. And that then was a system that we could actually interactively play around with bitmaps and make this stuff start to happen in a modern way.
Very interesting. So you mentioned, it sounds to me like you just defined a composable system, right, where none of the components of the system depend upon other components of the system for the system to function correctly and for you to build on top of it.
Yep, that's pretty much.
And you can switch out those components without breaking anything else, right?
Yeah, so Smalltalk 72 gave us the ability to do that. It had a number of weaknesses. It was really slow. But the flip side is that the turnaround time for a change was a quarter of a second. So we had this competition going in Xerox PARC between the computer science lab, and those were the guys working on serious programming languages like BCPL and then Mesa. And we were in the Smalltalk camp, and our secret weapon was that we had a turnaround between changes of a quarter of a second. They had maybe much better designed this or that. But so we'd have these meetings in which we had these Friday meetings called Dealer, in which people would say, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you could do this? And we'd go away and do it that afternoon and show it the next day. And then somebody else would come along and do a seriously engineered version a week or two later.
Yes, I mean, so one of the really strengths of those early Smalltalk systems, they were totally integrated environments, right? You created a very, very thin microcode virtual machine layer, right that enabled the fundamental sort of language semantics to execute, and then everything else on top of that was written in Smalltalk, right? And in a totally live, reflective manner in Smalltalk. So you didn't, you know, go off and build a program and compile it and load it on the machine and run it. You just go in with the online tools and start editing the running system. And that's how you got these incredible turnaround times, right?
That's right. Of course, you could destroy things easily,
right?
As well as build new things. But I think part of the thing that hadn't been recognized then, you know, doing everything by sending messages seemed like kind of an extreme thing in those days. But I think what people hadn't realized was the huge benefit that if that's how your system is put together, you can change any part of it while it's running. You know, it's like live plug and play, and there's no problem with that. And that's what gave us this great turnaround. You never had to relink or recompile. The only piece you had to compile was the little thing you were changing.
So you know, Dan, one of the things when I think about the web today, to me it feels very much like the Smalltalk environment that you were working with and really had invented in the late 70s and early 80s, that the web, if you look at the web as the whole or any complex site, it's this live thing that's always there, up and running, and you can... Individuals go in and you change very small pieces of it, like a page, kind of corresponds to a method, and you know, you compile that piece, and you can get errors on kind of installing that, but and stuff. But it's kind of the atomic unit that you change, but you change this unit, and everything around it is still alive and still running, and then the whole system sort of incrementally evolves, you know, over time. It, right. There's never one big bang, let's recreate the whole thing.
Right.
That's, so I always come back to saying, well, you know, a lot of what we learned in Smalltalk really applies to the web today, because it really is the same sort of world at a slightly different scale. I mean,
yeah, it's... Well, it's an interesting analogy. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's an analogy to make between with every URL being an object pointer.
Mm-hmm.
About the message sending, I don't think we really quite do things that way. Although there are interesting systems that have been built, just as a link, people might want to look at Wheat,
mm-hmm.
Mark Lenzner's work, which is pretty cool that way, which gets closer to a real sort of object-oriented model on top of the web.
Yeah, but even if you look at what people do today when they're building, you know, Ajax-based systems and sending, you know, JSON strings back and forth, carrying data, I mean, those are really, you know, interpreted at the receiving end and can be looked at as a message and you know, dynamically bound. So, so I think we're going there.
You're right. Yep.
So another question I had, Dan, was, so by the time I got involved in Smalltalk in 1980, I guess it was literally, the terminology and the concepts of object-oriented programming, kind of as we know them today, seem to be all pretty well developed in the material that was around Smalltalk. It was I actually first got involved as at Tektronix. We were a reviewer of what became known as the Blue Book, as sort of the book by Goldberg and Robson that really described Smalltalk for the first time in a complete thing, and we were reviewing that book. And all those concepts about objects and inheritance and messaging and were pretty well developed there. I'm kind of curious how in 1972 or 73 you got from some of these just first, you know, really simple concepts, and I don't know, maybe some knowledge of Simula and stuff came in there somewhere, but how the whole, you know, so sort of the whole Parthenon of what objects is all about, how that, you know, came about over that time.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, it is true there's a real intellectual debt to Simula there, Simula had a lot of the work had concentrated on doing simulations, but they were models of things happening in the real world, and they grouped behavior with the data. And, you know, I think if we deserve credit for anything, it's sort of for bringing that model to life, because theirs was a much more static sort of Algol-like environment. I'm trying to think of... So Smalltalk 72 was built to give us that kind of behavior. And I don't know who this originated with, but, you know, I sort of... I knew that we wanted to build a system we could play with, so the objects I was thinking of were the basic graphics, you know, points and rectangles, enough to put a user interface on the screen, because it was clear that that's what we were going to need to play with it, and numbers and character strings. So that naturally gave us a fairly small vocabulary to work with, and it was pretty clear what protocol each of these things would have. So we built Smalltalk 72 in a way that would allow you to build that kind of structure. If you look at the language Smalltalk 72, it's a very cool scripting language, but it's no efficient way to do message sending. It's nice in that you can see, just for people who don't know it, well, you should take a look at it sometime, but the code for a class actually consists of a linear set of operations that's looking at the incoming message stream, saying, you know, for numbers it would be, do you see a plus? If so, do this. Do you see a minus? So it's doing linear interpretation of a token stream. It's really inefficient, but it did let us build this system in that way, and we learned a great deal from it. And we learned also that we wanted inheritance, because we were trying to do the same kinds of things with arrays as with character strings. So it became clear that we wanted sort of some sort of collection superclass. So we knew that we wanted that, and we learned fairly soon that we wanted to be able to talk about the classes themselves as objects and be reflective that way. So it gave us a base that was imperfect, but it allowed us to really look at the world that way, I would say.
Hmm. And we're still sort of looking at the world that way today.
Oh, objects are objects are the mainstream computing paradigm today. I mean, I don't think anybody can really argue with that. It's
But I would ask is, you know, why wasn't Smalltalk really adopted? You know, why did no one really write consumer-grade applications in it?
See, I suppose that's a great lead-in to my piece of the story, because basically I got involved with Smalltalk when the guys at Xerox were trying to find a way to get broader adoption of it, and one of their schemes of it was, well, let's go to companies who build computers, and let's see if we can convince some people to build some Smalltalk-based computers. And that was because at the time it was done in microcode and all sorts of things, and it just seemed like you had to build a computer to run this language that you couldn't. It wasn't just a piece of software that you could load on any old operating system, because this was before it was before personal computers, really, you know, certainly before ubiquitous personal computer software and operating systems like Windows and stuff. And so, anyway, I was at this company, Tektronix, which at the time was probably the world's largest producer of computer graphics terminals, right? And Smalltalk was a highly graphic language and stuff, and so that was one of the companies that was a candidate to that, and they went to us and said, well, why don't you try to build a computer to do this? Okay, and I'll make a long story short. After we actually did it, after a lot of effort, and it turned out to be very difficult to do. But we actually eventually went to market with a machine that ran Smalltalk, and actually introduced a large number of people in the world to the concepts of object-oriented programming and Smalltalk. Mm-hmm. And I'll just name drop a bit, but along the way, I mean, part of that effort, coming out of that same effort at Tektronix, people who were involved with it and sort of introduced this technology, people like Ward Cunningham and Kent Beck, who've had, you know, really a lot of impact on a lot of technologies. They all started at Tektronix working with the Smalltalk implementations we were building and first got introduced to this technology. But anyway, so there was, I eventually went off to started my own company. It was called Instantiations. There were several other companies that were started, a company called Digitalk, a company called Park Place Systems, which came out of Xerox, companies who actually built Smalltalk implementations for commercial purposes. Hmm. And from, about 1986 to about 1996, there was actually a fairly significant segment of the industry that was focused on using Smalltalk for commercial programming. And at even one point along the way, in the press there were stories like Smalltalk was going to be the successor to COBOL. Because surprisingly, it surprised all of us, where Smalltalk found its largest adoption was in sophisticated IT organizations. Insurance companies, financial services companies, people doing complex financial systems. So Smalltalk had a lot of adoption. Probably every major insurance company in this country at one time had a major system that was implemented using Smalltalk.
There were good reasons for that.
Oh, yeah, it was.
What are some of these reasons? I mean,
A couple of things. So there was a piece of time relevance, which was people were outgrowing COBOL, and so they needed to migrate to something other than COBOL. There was this strange similarity. COBOL was a language that was designed to look a bit like English. Mm-hmm. And the Smalltalk keyword syntax and sentences that end with periods looked, you know, on the surface a bit like English. It was, you know, that was also a conscious decision. Mm. So there was that kind of similarity. And there was also Smalltalk's wonderful way of being able to model the world with objects. And this turned out to be be gangbusters for simplifying some of the financial and company modeling systems. And finally, for the people like, you know, Arthur Andersen, the consultants who were doing, you know, financial management for companies, they loved the fact that you could get in there, model stuff with much simpler code, and get turnaround time between changes just as fast as you could move. So those were all factors that I think really made a strong adoption there. And it continued to be strong until, interestingly, I think that it was Java's arrival
that basically
interrupted this. I'll call it interruption because Java brought along a lot of those strengths together with giving everybody the parentheses and C syntax that they were comfortable with who were still in the C camp. And this strange thing seemed to happen in the industry that everybody said, oh, that's the answer. Not realizing that, at least at that time, they were abandoning a lot of the really dynamic benefits. And so there was this period when and you can see it in attendance and Uppsala and things like that, everything just sort of quieted down there, a lot of focus on Java with lots of good work. Mm-hmm. And then it's been just in the last couple of years that people have kind of woken up and saying, wait a minute, we still need, you know, good dynamic properties and even the people in the Java camp working to support that. And so I feel it's another, you know, exciting time, and you've got things like Python and Perl and all this, you know, resurgence of interest in dynamic languages.
Just give me a bit more of my own spin on that is that, see, I think fundamentally people didn't adopt Smalltalk back then, or object-oriented programming for that matter, because they inherently wanted those things. They didn't really understand what they were all about. But what they wanted was there was a change in the paradigm of computing applications. The GUI interfaces were emerging. The Macintosh was what was there. And people building production applications wanted to build applications like that. And the solution that was presented to them was to build applications like that is you need an object-oriented programming language with a rich library, and the best language around to do that today is Smalltalk. And they said, okay, I'll try it. Mm-hmm. And many of them tried it and succeeded, and and they liked it. So my basic sort of thesis there is that changes in programming language, well, adoption of new programming languages tend to follow some sort of change in the basic environment of what people want to do, and then that enables people to make risky changes to try something new. Mm. Now, at the end of Smalltalk's first lifetime, and maybe there'll be more, but when Java emerged, that was as the internet was emerging, and everybody was saying, we need to build internet-based applications, and Java was presented as a technology that was a solution for building internet applications. And suddenly, all the sort of front-of-the-curb technologists who had been focusing on building GUI-based object-oriented systems and were adopting Smalltalk, suddenly they became focused on internet applications, and Java was the language of choice, and they switched. Mm.
That's interesting.
And that, you know, so I really think it's those sorts of kind of fundamental platform changes that really drive changes, you know, adoption of new languages and such.
So we're sort of in another one of those events right now, I mean, industry-wide, right? But it involves the internet. Because even at this, you know, people, it's all of the dynamic languages are the big thing right now. Mm-hmm. Ruby on Rails, right, all that stuff. And we're doing work in that area as well, yep. I'd imagine. So what is your take on that? I mean, could Smalltalk come back somehow? I mean,
oh, absolutely. And it, you know,
and why not?
And it depends also, you know, on what you call Smalltalk. I mean, we're surrounded by languages that are essentially Smalltalk underneath. You know, they're decent object-oriented languages. And and they're addressing various shortcomings of the original Smalltalk. I mean, people are learning the importance of modularity and the thing and the various design decisions that surround that. I think we're also encountering a whole bunch of interesting things that have to do with the sort of client-server bifurcation, the move towards distributed computing, not so much in both spaces, distributed over many machines and the security issues, but also distributed over multiple cores and the modularity issues. And what's fun about this time, you know, it's like if I think of the age of bitmap displays as being exciting with all the stuff that you can suddenly do, right now, multiple cores and many multiple cores is becoming a real reality. So you can get something on your desk that's holding a carrot out in front of you that says, if you do distributed computing right, you get to go 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times faster. So this is pretty exciting.
And Smalltalk helps this immediately because...
I don't see Smalltalk in and of itself helping you immediately. Doing object-oriented programming right helps you with that, and that's why the Smalltalk systems that are going in that direction of allowing you to take advantage of distributed computing, and the place I often point people at for the principles, for at least interesting and easy to understand principles for doing this, are the work on E, has quite a history too. But if you look at erights.org, erights.org, that's a great place to start. And E isn't so much a language. I mean, it's talked about as a language. It's really an architecture for doing processing in a sufficiently modular way and a sufficiently secure way to take advantage of what we're trying to do of the hardware that's available and to deal with the security issues we're trying to deal with.
So I have to tie this back to my analogy of the web to a Smalltalk image, because I think my sense is that a lot of the really dynamic features in Smalltalk, part of what drove their evolution was your need to evolve it in place in the environment you're working in, be able to change things, to change the definition of objects, and keep the system up and running the whole time. And I think a lot of the interest today in dynamic languages is because, again, of this sort of global computing web-based infrastructure we have, which is up and running all the time, and people have to make small incremental changes to systems as they run in place. They're basically always on, always alive, and they need the same sort of dynamic flexibility to evolve in place. You know, some people would say to bend and not break as the system changes, and dynamic languages, you know, offer that.
Interesting. And let's talk a little bit about why that's the case. Why dynamic languages offer that flexibility? Is it type issue?
Well, one way to look at it is what static languages try to do is ahead of time predict what's going to happen and decide whether this program will work in that predicted environment, right? Because that's what a type is. It says, here's the set of values I'm going to expect to have, and they must have all these characteristics, and you then try to analyze it ahead of time. Dynamic systems tend to, what they do is they check what the program actually does. Right, so when you statically check something over here, you might say, I'm sending the message foo to the object that's in this variable. I need to prove that every object I'm ever going to put into that variable will have foo, in case I because I might send it to it. Maybe it's in, send is predicated with an if, so I might or might not, but I'm going to make sure that I'm that it's always there. A dynamic system will say, well, I'm going to send foo, and if the object has it, everything will be fine, it will work, and it's great, you know, that's it. if it's not there, well, that's a problem, but something predictable will happen, and if the application needs to deal with that eventuality, then it can decide what to do if an object reaches that point that doesn't understand the message foo, but it's not going to try to perfectly analyze everything that might ever occur in the future.
Mm. Interesting.
That's kind of a simplistic way to look at it, but it's...
Well, that's good. That's good for me, right? I mean, you're trying to...
So just use but bigger words. So static systems tend to over-constrain the problem, right? Static checking will, in some cases, reject programs which, if you actually ran them, would work fine, right? Mm-hmm. So you get, false negatives, depending on what you consider to be negative and positive. But it's going to reject some programs which if you actually ran, would work. A dynamic system, if it works, it works, mm-hmm. you know. So that's, you can say, that's kind of this bending and not breaking type.
True.
Type character.
But when it breaks in runtime.
What breaks?
And
well.
And the consequences of something breaking in runtime over a distributed system can be, nice of you to know that ahead of time.
But if you're building a distributed system that's going to evolve over time, has to be, and is dealing with unreliable communications and stuff, has to be prepared to deal with breakage anyway.
Yeah, sure. I think that's the key, is you've got to have something that can evolve over time. And Alan's always had this phrase, you know, it ought to be like the Internet all the way down, just because, you know, we live with the Internet and it evolves, and we also deal with security on the Internet. So it's clear that there's a model there, at least for thinking about how things ought to be divided up. And as long as you have, you know, the security you need between the pieces, and it's fine, you know, if you go to a page and it refuses you for one reason or another, that's okay. It's not breaking down. That's just a limitation, you know, and that's how we deal with security and capabilities.
Interesting. I mean, what are your thoughts on you know, dynamicism, if that's the right way of looking at it, but not in an internet context, right? Let's like, so when you say take the internet all the way down, it could be taking the internet all the way down to the local system. And why aren't we using dynamic languages to write Windows applications?
Good question.
That's a good question. So the first Smalltalk systems that Dan were involved with, as I said earlier, went all the way from just a thin layer above the hardware all the way up to the user interface, and everything was done in Smalltalk. So Smalltalk essentially was the operating system. Were you the person who did the quote about... Okay, so another famous quote of Dan...
What is that? What is the quote?
...was, an operating system was a collection of things that, you know, didn't find their way into the programming language or didn't fit into the programming language. It's,
interesting.
Yeah. And the last part of it was there shouldn't be one.
Oh, yeah, and there shouldn't be, right.
There shouldn't be an operating system.
Well, essentially, that if the language is expressive enough, you should be pretty much living in the language. So then, you know, what you conventionally talk about is the command line interpreter it's just a little read eval print loop in the system itself, you know. The environment, your Windows superstructure will be in that system itself. You talk about what's the role of dynamic behavior there. Well, it should be possible in a system like that to create a new kind of window, you know, that didn't exist before while you're running, and hook it up, and provided that it obeys the protocol that's expected of the other windows in the system, it should just suddenly start working. This was a real aha to us when, in the very early days of Smalltalk, we had built the Windows package, and, you know, and most of the operations were being done with integers, you know, and the coordinates and everything. And I had a student working with me, and he came with this problem. He was having trouble debugging. And it turned out that way down in the bottom of our Windows code, he had floating point coordinates for his Windows. This has never happened before, but it just naturally propagated through the environment. You know, this wouldn't happen in other systems, but all we had to do was handle that one condition, and all of a sudden his Windows were working fine in a way that nobody had anticipated. But it's just provided that the interface is obeyed by some new component you put in there, it'll work fine. And so that to me is, you know, we were talking about how do you allow things to evolve in a system like that.
Interesting. So, you keep mentioning this, and I don't focus on it, but let's go back a little bit to BitBlip and the notion of creating. So you actually were one of the first people to create graphics on a screen. Am I understanding this correctly?
Well, people were doing that a lot, but in the very early days of that, everybody was writing their own code. So somebody'd have some nitty gritty assembly code for drawing lines, some other nitty gritty assembly code for. You know, for moving a patch of, once you got a model for bitmaps, moving a patch of graphics from here to there. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that there was, so in an early version of the Smalltalk system, we had separate code for this, separate code for scrolling an image up, separate code for drawing lines, separate code for filling areas with stipples, all of that kind of stuff. And when we sort of stood back from this and looked at it, you could see that all of this stuff dealing with bit alignment across words used common operations, and I thought about that, and I came up with this sort of model for copying areas from one bitmap to another that could have actually different raster sizes and all of that stuff. And it's one of these cases where, you know, if you pay your dues once and write, you know, this nitty gritty inner loop, then all the other code can use it. And there was an interesting piece of motivation here, which is that the early Xerox computers were microcoded. And this was a wonderful motivation to software engineers because there was the opportunity, and the microcode memory was somewhat small. So it meant if you could come up with a kernel piece of code that did this fancy thing, whatever it was, you knew that there was a carrot out there that your stuff would run five times faster. So that was what motivated me to do the inner loop of BitBlip. And so that all fit in the microcode and made all of those bit transfers run at full memory speed, even though they were having to align the bits, because that could all be shadowed under the memory access. Hmm. And later on, it motivated the work that I did on the Smalltalk bytecode engine, the virtual machine, because that also was a very small piece of code. You know, pick up the next bytecode instruction. For most of the common cases, you could do them right away. Again, at memory speed, it made it run like an actual hardware language engine. Hmm. And then it would fail out for more general things. So that was...
So I think, I mean, you have to put BitBlip in context a bit, is that... Until the early 70s, and particularly with the work of Xerox PARC, most computer graphics was vector graphics, and not really vector graphics as we talk about it today when we use the term, but
oscilloscopes.
But like oscilloscopes is simple lines drawn directly on the screen and a graphics device. That they had to be constantly refreshed, and graphics devices could maybe deal with a few hundred or a few thousand of these vectors at any one time. And so things like wireframe graphics and stuff you would see, because those are drawn with a bunch of vectors. But doing that sort of graphics, you can't create anything like a photographic image or a realistic scene or grays or, you know, any of the sorts of things you're used to seeing on a computer screen today.
And good text.
Good text. And so part of the process of inventing the personal computer at Xerox PARC was actually – putting a bitmap graphic screen onto a computer, one where every bit was controllable and you could create an image where you mm-hmm. controlled every bit. And so a lot of inventing BitBlit, I'm sure, was just coming up with how do you manipulate that bitmap that's mm-hmm. on the screen to create the visual effects that weren't possible with conventional computer graphics. So, you know, you can now put something on the screen that looks like a piece of paper, right? So what do you need to do to duplicate the appearance on paper using graphics and then make a live piece of paper that changes or scrolls or moves? And that's what BitBlit was for. It was doing all those things.
So then, I mean, one could argue that Xerox are the ones that created Windows.
Oh.
Not Windows TM.
I don't think there's any argument there. Yeah. I mean, okay. I think that's...
Well, I always hear, like, Apple created Windows, right? It's like, well, you know, it's a technology that clearly involves algorithms that you guys had written on the screen that you created, like he was just saying, with the control of each.
Well, yeah, certainly a lot of the early technology grew up there at Xerox PARC. But as I say, it wasn't the first occurrence of a window being put on the screen.
It wasn't.
No, I'm trying to think of the... I'm thinking whether Sketchpad had that, and then there was another system that... I think it was Grail had that in it.
Sketchpad certainly was a vector system, and yeah. I'm not sure. So even there, those systems, while they might have the concept of these layers, they weren't really able to create, I don't think, the same sort of visual, punchy visual effect that you get. You know, there are well-documented stories of Steve Jobs visiting Xerox PARC and getting a demo of Smalltalk and where things went from there. So it's...
I was one of the demoers.
Yeah.
So then you went to Apple and did what? Helped them write UI for their first OS or what?
No, actually, when I went to Apple... what I worked on there was picking up... Apple was another one of the early adopters for the Smalltalk system, along with Tektronix and a couple of others. And I picked up the work that had sort of been dropped there and carried it through to a release that was done to the Apple Programmers and Developers Association, sort of an open-source release. And that's the... that's the tie-in to Squeak, because that sort of stayed on the shelf then for, you know, a number of years until I came back. I went off to a whole other career. And then when I came back to computers, we wanted to do a Smalltalk system. This was when I rejoined Alan Kay's group. And I'd gotten the idea that you could actually write it all in itself. And so we looked around at a Smalltalk to start with, and that early Apple release was one that was in the public domain. So that's what we picked up and restarted with.
So now you said something really interesting. You said write something that's completely written in itself,
right?
Including the virtual machine.
Yeah. So the
because that doesn't happen in today's languages for sure. I mean, the CLR is C++. Java's virtual machine is not written in Java.
Right.
Anyway.
So, there are some circular systems around. There are Lisps written in Lisps. There are Prologs written in Prolog. And I don't know the PyPy work, but I think that that's in that space. But here was the idea was when we did the Smalltalk 80 release at Xerox, I worked with Dave Robson, and we wrote a complete version of the virtual machine, well, nearly complete, in Smalltalk as a documentation aid. But we actually made sure that it ran, because that allowed us to print out the first, you know, 1,000 bytecodes that you have to run and the first 1,000 messages that get sent, so that somebody trying to build a system from scratch, as Alan and his group did, could actually follow the traces, and it got them through the startup code much faster that way. So when we came back to that, when I came back to the industry, the machines were 50 times faster, and it suddenly occurred to me, whoa, you could run all of that in a Smalltalk system, sort of as your VM, and it would run usably. and this turned out to be the case. And then the one other step that we made was to write a the Blue Book version of the virtual machine was written in a subset of Smalltalk that didn't really use message sending, didn't really need it. So we wrote a translator from that to C, and that allowed you to also write out a version of the virtual machine that was totally faithful to the spec, but that ran much faster because it was essentially then compiled to machine code. So if you look at the Squeak system, it is the case that the whole virtual machine is written in Smalltalk. You can run it that way, even down to BitBlit itself, you know, the very every little bit that gets moved on the screen. Mm-hmm. It, you can play with it in Smalltalk and change its behavior.
Interesting.
And the translation to C is really just an implementation convenience. Right. I mean, you could have written a translator that translated it directly to machine code,
right,
and not have that sort of intermediate language. Yep. But it's
amazing how practical it is. The that interpreter that we run is between 20 and 50 times faster than a lot of JavaScript.
Yeah.
So
speaking
it's a very
of JavaScript, that's another language that's making a big resurgence, huh? Or I shouldn't say resurgence, it never went away. But I'm starting to hear, I hear a lot about how JavaScript is a great language, but we used to make fun of JavaScript about, I don't know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, we'd make fun of it. It was just silly interpreted little scripting language. And people were, we used to think it was weird that people were actually trying to build real applications using it. You know, this just comes from like C++ developers,
yeah,
and Windows developers, yeah, et cetera. And now it's all of a sudden becoming, wow, this is a super incredible language, super powerful. I mean, I don't know where I'm going with this, but
yeah,
you mentioned JavaScript. It sparked something in my head, and I just said what I just said.
So there's, okay.
What
so
do you make of the of this stuff?
So there's lots about it, and I'm not surprised that you know, sort of picked up all this. JavaScript has been around for quite a while, and the focus on it right now is that it happens to be supported in every browser, and therefore it's a great deployment vehicle for web-based software. And it was made to be a scripting language, but it was pretty... It's a fairly clean design. It's not a really clean language. So there are a bunch of redundancies in it, and there are a bunch of features in it. It's a prototype-oriented language and also an object-oriented language. There are a lot of things in it that you can do several different ways, so that redundancy makes it, you know, a lot of language designers say, whoa, I don't know. but it is quite a general language model. This makes it good for delivering web applications. The particular take I have on it, I've been playing, because it's available in every browser, I've been playing with the fact that you can actually write an entire system in it that's a web page. That's what the Lively Kernel work is. And there are lots of things that can be said about it, which it was not designed to be a programming language, and it's kind of, it's intellectual, it's interesting how the difference between a scripting language and a programming language. So a very simple example of this is that in a scripting language, you'd like it to tolerate as many errors as possible because you're going to put a web page out and you want it not to break. Okay, so there are lots of forgiving things in JavaScript. Things can be null and it will still work. As a programming language, it's not good if, you know, you've tolerated a null up here and five levels deeper, you get to finally a hard error because something wasn't initialized. You want to find that out earlier in a programming language. But there are ways around this, and there are interesting things being done with JavaScript. So, for instance, there's a subset language called AdSafe, which people use for allowing advertisements to be put on a web page. And so there's a scanner that certifies your ad save code that it's the subset of JavaScript that cannot damage the other page. So this is a beginning at real modularity. And to point at another project, there's the Caja project at Google, which actually is...
Oh, don't say Google. I'm just kidding. I'm just playing, man. This will be on the tape. I'm just joking.
Anyway, that's an attempt to... to come up with actually a secure JavaScript. I said it that way because it's an oxymoron. JavaScript is known as being sort of the most insecure of languages. But it is an object-oriented language. And if you take the subset of it that is object-oriented and build a capability-based security model in it, there's the potential there for actually having a secure language for the Internet. And that's what they're exploring. And I think the Caja, it's Spanish for box, so it, you think of that as being modularity, but I think it also came from CA, capability-based JA JavaScript.
And just I mean, pointing out how all things lead back to Smalltalk, of course. Of course, that's being done by Mark Miller, who did the E-language, who prior to that was a small talker and did lots of stuff with small talk. Mm. So, yeah, and, you know, small talk threads run through a surprising amount of the technology that we, you know, routinely use today. The other thing I just wanted to say about JavaScript was this probably isn't anybody's favorite language. You know, there's an expression that was coined by Dick Gabriel, worse is better, right? Which is trying to explain why it in most cases it turns out that the winning technology isn't what, you know, the best or the cleanest or what have you, but it's the thing that works good enough and gets out in the market. And so from the perspective of a dynamic language in a browser, I mean, JavaScript is there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's there. It's everywhere. Yeah. And it's being used. I mean, there's no choice but to use it. And so Dan, you know, with the Lively kernel is one example of demonstrating what you can do with it. Complex AJAX apps that people are building, are other examples of what you can do with it. Mm. And then the only other thing I throw in is, you know, the language has all sorts of warts, but as Dan says, at its core, it has the right fundamental concepts down there and stuff.
Good enough is the operating phrase.
Good enough. But the other thing you have to look at, and this is evolving now, this is changing, the other aspect of it is sort of the quality of the implementations, and particularly the performance qualities of the virtual machines. And most of the virtual machines that today are running JavaScript were designed 10 years ago, and were designed to run, you know, one-line fragments of code that were simple event handlers in the browser. It wasn't anticipated they would do things like what Lively does or what AJAX-style applications do today. There's all sorts of technology for how you to build, it's well-known for building better virtual machines for dynamic languages. Mm. And I think everybody in the industry who's involved with browsers and JavaScript and what have you are looking at how to build better virtual machines that will perform faster and execute this code in a much more efficient manner. So,
now, but I guess it begs the question. I mean, the language doesn't seem to be evolving at all, let alone of the.
I don't think that's true.
Well, let's talk about that. Has JavaScript evolved in 10 years?
Well, there's
12 years.
There's a fairly active program right now to in the ECMA group.
Uh-oh.
To come out with a new version which answers a bunch of people's needs.
Okay.
I would not say it's in the direction of a more elegant language, but it's
okay. And I want to be clear, that's really what I was talking about, because when you see how C# evolves and how C++ evolves. I mean, the languages, they change over time. Mm-hmm. New features are added, new semantics, new ways of thinking about things. It's still that language, but things are added to it. And I don't see that happening. That's all I meant by
Well, so let me address that.
Okay.
So it's a question of who gets to say what it is. But so ECMA is taking it forward in this particular direction, which will make it more useful as a programming language.
Okay.
The AdSafe folks have taken it in a direction that makes it safer, somewhat more modular.
Okay.
And the Caja project that I mentioned is taking it in a direction that's seriously more modular. And it's a very nicely done design. It remains to be seen where it will end up, but it's a pure subset. Therefore, it will run in every browser still. It will not have its serious security advantages until it's put on a different virtual machine. But it actually cleans up the language. And in ways that people have said Smalltalk could be cleaned up, you know, eliminating references to shared state, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
So there are evolutionary threads there. Right now, the JavaScript that we all know is the one that runs in all the browsers, and you're right, that hasn't evolved. But there are several future directions. And you know, my interest in it is just that, you know, back in the old days, every machine came with BASIC, so it was fun to see what you could do with BASIC.
Mm.
And I always lamented the fact that none of the BASICs were written in BASIC. I remember when I got my first BASIC, I thought, gee, wouldn't it be neat if the BASIC system was at all the negative line numbers and you could go back and play with how it worked. But they never did that. Anyway, with Java, as we get it, you know, now it's the case that every browser comes with JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, it's something that's out there that sort of everybody can play with. I mean, my cell phone has it in it. So I think of all the fun I could be having if I just, you know, could get at it. So.
Absolutely. So if you... And you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say about the evolution of JavaScript. You know, realistically, until about 2 years ago, and until the AJAX style of programming started to emerge, people didn't look at the browser as a programming platform, right? Yeah. It was looked at as a presentation platform.
Right.
And so there wasn't a lot of market pressures pushing the evolution of the JavaScript language. But when people, you know, decided it was time to start creating richer application experiences in the browser and develop AJAX-style techniques for doing that, suddenly JavaScript emerged as a real programming language. Mm-hmm. And that renewed interest in the language, that renewed interest in people building better virtual machines and engines to run it. It also renewed interest in how the language is going to evolve. But that's only been in the last couple of years. And
okay.
So there's lots of activity in the industry around how should JavaScript evolve and what directions and various alternatives. We just haven't really seen in show up yet in the browsers, you know, too many of the effects of those. But, you know, over the next few years, I think we will start to see that.
So, I mean, we had an earlier conversation today, and people have already seen this on Channel 9 with some panelists, Eric Gilad and Mads. And we talked about sometimes the need to throw away the old to build something new, right? And so here's a kind of a good example of where that could happen in the sense that if you didn't look at the internet and browsing the internet as a programmable kind of context, but now we kind of see that it is. So you don't have a huge amount of history. Certainly there's big apps written in JavaScript. Windows Update, for example. I know it because I worked on it. It's lots of JavaScript, man. So what I would, you know, what I'm asking is, what about like a real programming language? And I hate to say real, but like a sophisticated programming language with lots of power and a powerful virtual machine. That becomes what you program for the web experience that runs in a browser. Now, you're going to probably say that it's about getting it onto the client. But isn't that always a problem? I mean, you have to have Java. Remember, one of the cool things about Java were the applets that were created for web pages. Early on, you could do like really cool thing in like the mid-90s or so.
Right.
You know, you could shake a teacup around or spin the earth around or something. It was interesting kind of way. You're like, wow, this is a new way to interact with the web. But you had to download a virtual machine and install it on your system.
Right.
So my question is that really enough to say that just because of ubiquity of these old VMs around, aren't people going to have to install the new VMs anyway when you guys come out with them for JavaScript? So I don't really know exactly what I'm asking. I'm just saying stuff, but there is definitely a question here. And that is, if you, you know, couldn't this be a good example of where you try to get people to just think of doing something in a different way? Right?
Sure.
Yeah, you have to install a new virtual machine, you know, but you can do something that's so much more powerful.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, there's no reason that all the clients can't have various virtual machines just like all the desktops. And there's also the potential of having a general dynamic virtual machine that could run all of these systems. I don't know, I'm sure you're working on things like that at Microsoft, and also, you know, if you look at some of the work like Ian Piumarda's COLA kernel, there are several ways of doing that, and if that kind of kernel were in all the browsers, then you could have JavaScript if you wanted. You might have some even better language, equally available. And there's no, you know, people resist downloads, but there's no reason that can't be made as secure as all the other stuff you want to make secure.
I mean, absolutely.
If you're willing to work with your bank, you ought to be able to work with your language supplier.
Yeah, I mean, when you surf the internet, you know, by definition, you're downloading all the time. Right. In one case, small amount of stuff, strings and some JScript, right, yep. That gets parsed and ran in your browser. Sometimes it's bigger binary junk, like...
Yeah. There's two sorts of changes that can be made. There are changes that simply make what's there better. So if you create a new virtual machine or a faster virtual machine, that can be shipped in a new version of the browser, or it can be a dynamic download that installs into a browser. But it runs the same programs that are already there. It just runs them faster. So the developer of the application on the web or the website doesn't have to do any work to take advantage of that. It's a quality of implementation thing. The implementation quality got better. Mm-hmm. And so those are relatively easy things to get out in the world, and it can be deployed very incrementally. Some users have it, some people don't. Mm-hmm. But when people build websites that are going to be broadly used, one of the first things they look at is the vast majority of browsers that people are using, do they support this technology I'm using in my application? And that's one of the things I've learned about web apps over the last few years, talking to web application developers, is they're really only interested in features that are available on all the browsers, because they don't want to build applications targeted to one single browser, because there's a variety of them in the world, and different people use them, and you can't control. The user picks the browser, not the application writer.
Sure.
Right? And so they're looking for features that are really very ubiquitous. And that's the real challenge, is how do you get these new technologies that the application developer has to make a conscious decision to use, how you actually get them into the browsers, so that everybody can use them. Just kind of wrapping that idea up is Douglas Crockford of Yahoo. I think this is a quote from him, but he describes this problem as most application developers, when you you get to pick a programming language, and you get to pick which compiler the language is going to use, and you build the application, and you deploy it, and those are all decisions you've made, and it's all wrapped up, and you have control over the whole thing. Mm. When you're a web application developer, the end user who runs the application chooses which compiler, which engine, runtime engine, is actually going to run the program, and what the surrounding environment is. And as the application developer, you don't have any control of that. So you have to build stuff that's going to work no matter what runtime environment the user provides for it to run in. And that's a very different sorts of situation that non-web application developers usually don't face.
Yeah, absolutely. That was kind of... I guess that was the focus of the challenge that I was looking at with the Lively Kernel, which is there is some subset that sort of everybody can get at, which is JavaScript and the certain graphics model. And so I was curious to see, can you really build an entire self-supporting system in that? And a lot of my interest has to do with kids in schools, because a lot of schools have firewalls and they refuse to download software. So you're sort of, in terms of something radically new and creative to give them, it's got to be just a web page. Mm-hmm. So, but it did occur to me, well, you know, if we've got JavaScript there and some graphics, that web page could be an entire self-supporting system. And it's, I've always liked self-supporting systems because they're the one totally general thing you can give to somebody. You know, it's like a, you know, it's like a musical instrument. Eventually, you know, a Beethoven, a Paganini will come along and do things you hadn't envisioned. And if you can give them that kind of generality, whatever the language, they will do incredible things. And I wanted to make that available sort of in any browser, ideally in every cell phone.
Outstanding. And, you know, by using HTML and JScript coming down as the application, you're able to solve that. CSS, probably.
So I purposely was avoiding all of that.
Really?
Yeah. So the Lively kernel is written only using JavaScript.
Only using JavaScript.
No HTML, no CSS. And
so you could go from Volta to Lively kernel. Interesting. But that brings up a really good point.
Possibilities are endless.
Well, it's cool because we're talking about development tools, right? So if you think about from an application developer's point of view, you know what, let's be honest. Maybe I don't want to write, you know, freaking 1,000 lines of JScript or 10,000 lines of JScript right. And a bunch of this ugly HTML and then do all the CSS junk, which really isn't a programming language at all.
Right.
But in fact, I want to use something like C#, for example. Just you can use an example. I like the language. I like the CLR.
Yeah.
So I write this wonderful application in C#, and then lo and behold, there's this magical thing I could use, and then it could spit down JScript and HTML and whatever else kind of stuff needed. It could run in any browser. So there's actually, you know, that's I just kind of had an epiphany because I sort of understand now that's one of the cool things about technology that's already out there. So basically, the developer gets to have the full development experience with a real language, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, there's this translation that can happen
right.
in the sky that right. sends it down to cell phones and anything you want. But me, as a developer, I got to use my tools, man. I got to debug across tiers in the case of Volta,
yep.
something you can do. So that's really very interesting, putting the pieces together from what I learned today anyway.
Yeah, it's just defining what your target platform is. And that's what, I mean, Volta is an example of saying, well, the browser is a target platform, and its execution environment is JavaScript. Google's GWT is really another example of that. It's doing the same, similar thing for Java. There are other languages around that translate into JavaScript, but it's people are recognizing that the browser environment is a ubiquitous execution environment, and then if you want to invent other languages or other tools that you think are going to help the developer, well, you need to translate it into something that will work in that environment.
Absolutely. And so that would be nice that if, for example, I could as a developer, since you write great tools and stuff, but one of the things that would be cool would be able to, the developer only cares about the development, my favorite development experience, my development language, my debugger. And then, with clever technologies, I just say, compile this to run in this execution context.
Mm-hmm.
Send it off. Mm-hmm. Compile it to run in this execution context. Because I just want this to run on Vista, for example.
Right.
I know the CLR is going to be there.
Right.
That, to me, seems like a good way to go about the future. Hit it right at the front end so that you don't really care about the compilers that are happening on the client side at runtime, right? Because you can just target them like you were just saying, but I do it up front, a priori knowledge of what I want to target. But one code base, which is what's great about MSIL, anyway, and then converting it to something else. But that's, you can do that in any intermediate language.
So here's the one difference between that and my sort of focus of interest, which is, and it goes back to the stuff we talked about earlier about having control over the entire environment. In my system, you're there, if you don't like how the windows work, if you want your controls over at this side, inside of it you can change them on the fly and save that on a new web page, and that's your new environment. So it may not be how you would want to work on applications, But this is the nature of a reflective system, a system that's written in itself, which is if you are that special creative kind of guy who sees a really better way to do not just the application, but the system, the development system itself, you can change that and evolve. So it's a kind of a, in that sense, it's a very narrow market. But it's an opening of creativity. And it's also kind of a proving ground for the language and system. You know, is it complete in that sense? And this is the phrase is self-supporting system. You know, and a system that's that way is by definition all you need for it to take care of its own evolution.
Fascinating.
So it's just a particular perspective.
Yeah. And that's thus the name Lively Kernel, because it sort of has life to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very interesting.
We gave it that name for a couple of reasons. It's live because it starts running the minute you hit the web page. There's no need to install any software. It's live because it can change its own graphics and programs. And it's lively because it can store web pages out of itself. So without having installed anything, you can actually write its applications onto a new web page or even clone itself.
Interesting. Wow. So is this viewable these days, or is it not out yet?
Yeah, so if you just Google for Lively Kernel.
Google? I mean live search.
Excuse me, that's what I mean.
See, that's the problem. We didn't come up with a cool name.
That's right, yep.
All right, well that's cool. So it's Lively Kernel.
Lively Kernel, yep. And you'll see it. And it's a work in progress, and folks are welcome to get on the mailing list and contribute and play with it.
Cool. And then, of course, I could use Volta to take that and take the Lively Kernel, convert it to C#.
There you go.
Because it's a two-way game with
That's
Volta.
That's right. Yep. Yeah,
cool.
That'd be cool.
Excellent. Well, hey, listen, I've had you guys here for a long time. I really appreciate it. We never really, Alan, what the heck are you doing these days?
Oh, well,
you talked about your past.
So I work in I work in the Visual Studio organization, and I work in sort of on a sort of strategy and planning for what we do with dynamic languages in general. And I certainly have an interest in dynamic languages, and I'm involved in Microsoft's efforts about evolving JavaScript and ECMAScript and stuff like that. Basically, try to keep people on track here and remember that dynamic languages exist and evangelize them. And so,
excellent. Well, hey, thank you guys for your time. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks.
And enjoy the rest of the show. Great conference.
Thanks.